It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now, more on a heartbreaking story we heard in our news from Southwest Iowa and Omaha. Omaha police officer Carrie Orozco, a 29-year-old native of Walnut, Iowa, was one day away from going on maternity leave to care for the daughter she delivered prematurely 3 months ago when she answered a call to help a fellow officer. Minutes later, Officer Orozco lay in a yard, fatally wounded. That was last Wednesday. Tuesday of this week, she was laid to rest in a Council Bluffs cemetery. Orozco was the first female officer for the city of Omaha to be killed in the line of duty and the first Omaha officer in more than 10 years to die while serving. Joining us now, Officer Ken Fox of the Omaha Police Department. Ken Fox, thank you very much for joining us at this painful time.
Thank you for having us.
You and Officer Orozco were good friends, I understand. You were in a gang unit together for more than 4 years. Very, very sorry for your loss, for all the friends she had there. The devastation to your department, very sorry for that, sir.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, Carrie Orozco's family and close friends honored her at a church funeral in Omaha. We heard the reports, hundreds of colleagues attending the service, thousands more law enforcement officers, first responders traveling from around the country to watch this video feed at the in downtown Omaha. She was buried at St. Joseph Cemetery in Council Bluffs. And along the way on that funeral procession, 8 miles, groups of people lining the street to honor her. A fitting tribute to a remarkable woman. Tell us a little bit about her.
Oh, Carrie was a great friend, a great colleague, and a great citizen of Iowa, and a great citizen of Omaha. She cared deeply for at-risk youth. She cared deeply for her friends, her family, and she was all about the betterment of the community that she served. She's a very selfless person. She always looked for the good in everyone that she met, and she wanted to help people. I mean, she was a great woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, a great woman.
She had postponed her maternity leave while her baby, Olivia Ruth, remained in the hospital in the prenatal care unit, I understand. Olivia Ruth was born prematurely back in February, and the baby was to be released from the hospital the day after her mother was killed. How is the family being supported at this time?
You know, her husband, Hector, he's a very strong and proud man. He is being supported tremendously by the department. I mean, my hat goes off to this department and what they did to make sure that they tributed Carrie like she should have been, and also respecting the wishes of the family. We've set up liaisons, people that were really close to Carrie, to be that contact with the family to make sure that everything is going smoothly. And I know that it just didn't stop after the funeral. We will continue to support that family. We will continue to support Olivia Ruth. And I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's bringing you know, it's saying Olivia Ruth's name. It's just it tears me up inside. But I know that out of this tragedy, she's received, you know, maybe a couple hundred guardian angels now that will be looking over her and protecting her for the rest of her life.
I understand there's also a college fund, donations being taken for a college fund for Olivia Ruth, the little Olivia Ruth?
Yes. I know a college fund is being taken for, and also at the Omaha Police Federal Credit Union in Omaha, they're taking funds for the family also in the Carrie Orozco Family Fund. From what I'm hearing, there's just hundreds and hundreds of people, thousands of people across the country that are touched by this story and donating and reaching out to help this family. It's just wonderful. Out of this tragedy, And I can't wrap my mind around it. I just really can't. I can't understand the plan, and I probably will never will be able to understand that plan. But one thing I can say is what I've seen is the outpour of the community and the nation that have recognized this you know, this beautiful woman's her work that she did and her passions, and recognize it and celebrate it. And I mean, that's one good thing I can get out of this whole situation is that. But it's hard for me to even understand what happened.
Officer Fox, were you on the scene when Officer Orozco was fatally shot last Wednesday?
I was probably the fifth or sixth person on scene.
What happened?
It was chaos. It was chaos and just seeing the whole situation. I don't, you know, someone that beautiful doesn't deserve to be in that situation. I mean, she gave the ultimate sacrifice to protect this community. And, you know, it's for me being a friend, I don't think anyone should ever see a friend in that situation. It's going to be hard to recover.
Mm-hmm. You were with her when she died.
I was there. Yes, I was. And it's heartbreaking. It's something that I'll never forget. And I'm hoping that I can move on.
Mm-hmm. What has the atmosphere been like at the Omaha Police Department since this death?
You know, I'd say Carrie touched so many people, a lot of people, especially in my circle. We're grieving. We're grieving tremendously. You know, just because, you know, I love everyone on this department. You know, they are your brothers and sisters in blue. But it's a little different when it's someone that when the clock stops, you still deal with, you still work with. And me and Carrie worked a lot with the community. We did a lot of things. We were in the same organizations, and she shared my passion. I shared her passion, excuse me, of community service. And for us, it's difficult. For us, it's very difficult. I mean, we're still mourning. I think from other police officers, I think the solace they can take in it is just seeing the support from the community, and also seeing what Carrie did, what she lived every day. I think they see that we can do better. You know, we can do better. We can try to match up to what Carrie, her vision was on this department. So I think in the community, they see that there are a lot of good police officers out there that care about them. And I think on the department, we see that we can do better.
Officer Ken Fox of the Omaha Police Department, thank you for helping us know who Carrie Orozco was and honoring her and her life and the service to the community. And we wish you all the best, you and your colleagues there, in healing after this tragedy. Thank you, Officer Fox.
Thank you for getting her story out. I appreciate you guys.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, the Iowa Supreme Court issued its ruling on a bitter battle between the governor, Governor Branstad, and Democratic legislators over whether the governor illegally closed a state school for troubled teen girls last year. Joining us now to talk about the case and today's decision by the Iowa Supreme Court, Ryan Copemans is with us. We'd like to turn to Ryan. He's an attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Legal Matters. Ryan, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back. So what did the justices rule today?
Well, this is, to some, maybe a disappointment, I guess. We had this big, as you said, this big battle between some legislators and the governor about whether the governor had the constitutional power to close this juvenile home, which the legislature had appropriated money for. So the legislature appropriated $8 million throughout the year, and they said, well, we expect that $8 million to be spent on this home. The governor, on the other hand, and other members of his executive branch decided that it was not in the children's best interest to continue to be there, and so he closed it. So you had this fight, you know, this essentially this civics lesson, where who gets to decide how the money's spent, the executive branch or the legislative branch? And they asked the court to do that, so we all thought we'd get this big constitutional case that says, well, here's what the Constitution means, here's what the governor can or cannot do. Instead, we got a lesson from the Iowa Supreme Court in restraint. What they said that, no, we're not going to decide. This case is moot. In the 2014 legislative session, the legislature and the executive branch, the governor, essentially worked it out amongst themselves. They decided that we're not going to fund this juvenile home anymore. And so even if the court wanted to order it to be reopened, there's no money. And the court said, look, it is not our job under our constitutional government to get involved in fights between the executive and legislative branch when they've essentially solved them themselves. And so we are not here to answer academic questions. We are a judicial body that solves real legal disputes. This is no longer one. And so, therefore, we're dismissing the case. So a soft end to a bitter battle.
Mm-hmm. Is it really the end? Is that the end of this controversy? Does it end here?
Well, that's the end of this controversy. You know, we'll see. Maybe there will be another controversy with some of the other closures that might happen after this legislative session is over. So we might see this issue come back. But this case brought by, you know, the AFSCME president and some Democrat legislators, including Jack Hatch, who ran against the governor, is officially over.
Mm-hmm. I think you're referring to the critics of Branstad have accused him of using similar tactics to this in shutting down state mental hospitals at Clarinda and Mount Pleasant this year. I think the timeline for that coming up here in June. So this ruling, does it in any way address that controversy at all?
No, it doesn't, because the court didn't weigh in on what power the governor has, but it does tell the legislature, look, if you really want to keep these things open, then you need to appropriate money for it, because we're not going to come in after the fact, after you essentially have given in and rule that the governor must reopen these things. If you want to stick up for yourselves, then you must appropriate the money, and if you don't, then don't get us involved.
Mm-hmm. Is that the message? Is that the precedent here for this dismissal of a case?
It is. And essentially what the court is saying is, look, if you read between the lines, this is a very gray area about where the power of the legislative branch ends and where the power of the executive branch begins. And the court says, look, this is a very dangerous constitutional fight. And unless we have a active fight in front of us, unless you're willing to continue on, then we're not going to draw the lines for you.
Okay, Ryan Copeman, attorney at Nymaster Good in Des Moines. Thanks for explaining the case dismissal by the Iowa Supreme Court on this battle between the governor and some Democratic legislators over whether the governor illegally closed a state school for troubled teens last year. Thank you, Ryan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News continues. Quick conversations to round out our week, and it has been a week in politics this week and next. More candidates joining the field of the 2016 presidential candidates this week. Let's look at who joined this week. We heard former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, also winner of the 2012 Iowa caucuses, getting into the race. Also former New York Governor George Pataki, there's a familiar name. And this weekend, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley will become the third official candidate in the Democratic field. Next week, Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, announces Rick Perry. We know that name as well. Former governor of Texas on June 4th, joining us with a few of his thoughts at this point. 8 months from the first in the nation Iowa caucuses and amidst a flurry of declaring candidates. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science and the Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Good. Let's see. We have less than 10 minutes. Where do we start? Any of these top contenders in the latest round of candidates to declare strike you as top contenders or long shots?
Well, you know, if I wanted to be completely cynical about the whole thing, I would ask, do we really want someone as president who has so little connection to reality that he actually thinks he's got a chance at becoming president?
go for all of them.
Well, not all of them, but, you know, Governor Pataki was a respected governor, Republican governor of New York. He explored this possibility in 2007 early and decided not to go ahead and do it. I mean, there's just no way he could get through a Republican primary process. I mean, Rick Santorum is an interesting case because, of course, he has strong residual support here in Iowa, although so does Mike Huckabee. And Huckabee, along with Ted Cruz and Bobby Jindal, certainly want to compete for that same constituency that supported Santorum. But, you know, he's been around the block himself, and he's focused his attention on what he calls blue-collar conservatism, or a kind of populist economics. And I've been at various venues where he's spoken, and the audience has been singularly unmoved by those appeals. So I don't know if those appeals would actually go very far in a Republican primary process. They might actually go farther in a general election, get through the Republican process.
A few words about Martin O'Malley in the Democratic field.
Well, he basically is a rounding error at the moment in polls. It hurt him tremendously that when he left office in Maryland, the Democrats couldn't hold on to that governorship. Maryland's a very liberal state, although they did elect Bob Ehrlich, a Republican governor, some years ago, I believe, before Martin O'Malley. But that's considered a mark against him. You know, there's the question, I guess, is who would be the un-Hillary, so to speak? If for some reason her candidacy would implode, then where would the Democrats go? And the problem for Democrats is they have a pretty thin bench. Bernie Sanders is someone who will say really interesting things and be tremendous fun to watch. But in the American political system, having the word socialist anywhere within shouting distance or even GPS distance of your name has been the kiss of death for close to 100 years. So, you know, Democrats, in a sense, may be stuck with Hillary for good or for ill. And perhaps O'Malley or even Sanders just wants to be there just in case her candidacy implodes.
Mm-hmm. We're expecting 15 or more on the GOP side in this nomination fight. And historically, I think we heard on Morning Edition pointed out, of course, by you as well, that when we have a two-term president, the likelihood that it's going to be followed by a president of the same party is historically pretty low.
Right. Since Truman, that's happened only once, and that was George H.W. Bush in 1988, and most people said he basically won Ronald Reagan's third term. Interestingly, a third term prohibited to him by the constitutional amendment, the 22nd Amendment, that was passed by a Republican Congress when they took control of Congress after the 1946 elections. But, yeah, it's very tough, number one. Number two, I think Republicans think that because of the relatively slow recovery from the recession, although things are a lot better than they were, still the average person, I'm not sure, thinks we are in better shape. They think that makes it a Republican year. And they think that a lot of people are very tired of the Obama administration, both in domestic and in foreign policy. So you've got all these folks running to a great extent because they think it's a Republican year and they hope lightning will strike.
Mm-hmm. How will this huge Republican field be winnowed in the weeks to come? What form will it take? What do you expect?
Well, you know, traditionally fundraising is what did it, as people didn't get out of single digits in polling or in various events like the Iowa Straw Poll or the caucuses or even New Hampshire. If you fail to meet expectations, that's dried up the money really quickly. Now, the interesting thing to watch will be how much that's changed because of Citizens United, that now you can have a sugar daddy or sugar mama who's sufficiently wealthy to support you despite the fact that your poll numbers are low, as with Sheldon Adelson and Newt Gingrich last time around. Are these people going to change the nature of that winnowing process? But that aside, of course, the big problem is how are they going to schedule reasonable debates that really aren't, you know, shouting matches or bumper sticker phrases, even worse than usual, with this whole crowd on the stage? And we've already seen Fox and CNN attempting to winnow that somewhat. And of course, the other candidates are told you can't compete because your poll numbers are too low. And their response is, yeah, but if you'd let us compete, that would raise our poll numbers. So you have a chicken and egg situation, at least that they'll claim.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Iowa Straw Poll yesterday. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey signals he's prepared to have a presence at this straw poll scheduled for August 8th, though he's not a declared candidate yet. It's a Republican Party of Iowa hosting this political gathering every 4 years. the summer before the Iowa's first in the nation caucuses. Now, the viability of the Iowa straw poll has been in doubt this year, this cycle. Explain why.
It's all Michelle Bachmann's fault. In other words, I mean, the straw poll for years has been, for those of us who watch this, tremendous fun, a big carnival, and you get to stroll around and see all these media people and all these politicians. So from our standpoint, it's been tremendously fun. Does it serve the Republican Party? That's the big question, because in a sense, at the risk of offending some people, it's the Iowa Republican Party essentially kind of extorting money from their national campaign, saying if you don't play in this, buy tickets and all that, you're going to do badly in the caucuses. So they've held their own national candidates hostage in a way to the funding needs of the Iowa Republican Party. And when it's produced winners like Michelle Bachmann who go nowhere, you know, we usually have a complaint from Republicans out of state that the caucuses themselves distort the process. Well, whether or not the caucuses do, the straw poll certainly has, in that it's knocked out people who on paper should seem plausible candidates like Tim Pawlenty, and advanced people like Michelle Bachmann, who simply weren't serious candidates.
Mm-hmm. And so the continuance of the straw poll, do you see it continuing on in any meaningful way?
We'll see how they have to do it this time. I mean, I read reports suggesting that Governor Branstad thought it had outlived its usefulness, but the party itself seemed to want to have it. But if they're not auctioning off spots, we'll see if and how it raises any money and who actually participates. So, I mean, remember, in 2011, there were somewhat over 600,000 registered Republicans in the state of Iowa. A total of 16,800 votes were cast in that straw poll.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Michelle Bachmann first, Ron Paul a close second, and Rick Santorum finished fourth, saying we're on the move. And of course, it worked out for him, but not because of the straw poll.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, can you give me some key words that will indicate what you think is likely to drive the ultimate outcome of this primary season in terms of issues? I'm looking at Nate Silver of 538.com. He says polarization and the economy are the drivers. Do you agree? Do you add to those?
I would agree, but increase, because again, especially for the Republicans, what can get you through the Republican primary process, the question is whether in fact it could get you through a general election. Ted Cruz is betting it can. Somebody like Jeb Bush is betting that it can't.
Okay.
But national security normally isn't as big an issue, but it is now.
Okay. Dennis Goldford, always great to have you on of Drake University. Thank you, Dennis.
Good to talk to you.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, the latest controversy over Iowa's Field of Dreams. Also, a native Iowan who calls Ireland home with his perspective on that same-sex marriage referendum there last weekend. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, we'll get an update on the avian flu, the toll that it's taking, and also look into the next chapter, the latest chapter, on the legal controversy over Iowa's Field of Dreams. But before that, this past weekend, the people of Ireland backed same-sex marriage by a landslide in a referendum that marked a dramatic social shift in this traditionally Catholic country. We have to remind ourselves that Ireland is a country that only decriminalized homosexuality 2 decades ago. This past weekend marked one of the largest turnouts in a referendum in Ireland, with 62% of voters saying yes to same-sex marriage. And this makes Ireland the first country in the world to adopt same-sex marriage via popular vote. Stephen Johnson is joining me now from Ireland. He's a freelance journalist who writes for publications in Ireland and also here in the United States. He's lived and worked in Ireland for some 10 years, grew up in Iowa City, I understand, graduated from Grinnell College, also worked as a political reporter for some time at the Des Moines Register. Stephen Johnson, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, Ben.
You've been covering the same-sex marriage debate there for a couple of years, I understand. Was the landslide a surprise?
Yes, it was. The polls had showed that there was growing support for equal rights for gay and lesbian people and for same-sex marriage, but the support was thought to be very soft. And the effort that was launched by the folks here in Ireland was to firm up that support and to run a really an American-style campaign to try and get support for the referendum in Dublin, the capital, which accounts for more than half the country's population. The vote for yes last weekend topped 70%. And the really surprising thing to me is that in the rest of the country, out where we live, older, more rural and conservative and Catholic, the yes vote was still carried by a percentage of 55 to 45. That was the real surprise. And it was no surprise that younger voters, both gay and straight, voted yes, even by an astonishing 80%. And women, too, strongly supported the referendum. But what was surprising to me and to a lot of other observers was the support for the referendum among middle-aged and elderly voters across the country who might have been expected to oppose the referendum.
What was it that made the difference, the way that the yes vote and the no vote campaigns conducted their campaigns?
Well, that was a lot of it. And the equality campaign was the yes equality campaign. And insiders would tell me or remind me that one of the inspirations for the Yes Equality campaign came from Barack Obama's campaign way back in 2008. Remember Yes We Can?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of the Yes Equality people here would walk around town saying, telling people that wanted to vote but weren't sure, they would say, "Yes, we can." So there was a little of the, maybe more than a little of the Barack Obama and modern digital social media American political grassroots campaign in what went on here.
What about those who argued against this referendum? The Catholic Church, for one.
Well, the church was the leading voice in opposition, and that would not be a surprise. Remember that less than 20 years ago, homosexuality was a criminal offense. And the church's teaching through the centuries has been that homosexuality is a mortal sin. And they were in a tough position because they had to come up with arguments against the referendum that appealed to a broader audience. And so what they talked about was potential threats or problems for children and issues of surrogacy and adoption. But the message didn't get through. This remains a heavily Catholic country, but the results showed that a lot of the Catholics in Ireland chose to ignore the direction that they were getting from their bishops and their parish priests and voted instead in favor of the referendum.
In fact, in one of your articles after the referendum, you write that the day after the votes were counted, a Dublin archbishop admitted that the church needed to do, quote, a reality check. I think he gave a radio interview, a reality check. So what does that mean, do you think, for the Catholic Church?
Well, the interview you referred to was over RTE, which is the Irish counterpart to National Public Radio back in the States. And he acknowledged that the church needed to do a reality check, that the results of a referendum showed that the church had been out of touch, particularly with younger people, and it needed to take a look at itself and how it interacts with young people and try and move forward from that. So it was a promising response from the archbishop here, and he closed his interview by saying, "I appreciate how gay and lesbian men and women feel today. This is something that they feel will enrich the way they live here in Ireland, and I think it's been a social revolution."
Mm.
And of course, what the referendum, what the campaign showed, as it has in other countries, is that the key to success was to talk to people on a personal level and to identify a large majority of people, even in Ireland, who, if not gay and lesbian themselves, had members of their family, friends, who were gay and lesbian. And here in my little town of Kenmare, which is a small farming, fishing, and tourism committee out here on the west coast of Ireland, it voted more than 60% of in favor of the referendum. And as I walked through town in the last couple of days, many of my friends and neighbors told me that they had gay and lesbian friends and family members, but also that they wanted their children and grandchildren to grow up as fully equal members of Irish society.
Stephen Johnson, you've lived in Ireland now for over 10 years as a freelance journalist. You write for publications in Ireland and America, but you are a native Iowan. Let's compare. In 2009, Iowa became only the third U.S. state to legalize same-sex marriage, not through a referendum like Ireland, but through the Iowa Supreme Court striking down a ban on same-sex marriage, said it was unconstitutional under Iowa's Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution. As a native Iowan who's lived and worked in Ireland for a good number of years, what are your observations about how Ireland and Iowa arrived at legalizing same-sex marriage?
Well, Ireland and Iowa arrived at very different paths. And the reason this is so important is that the referendum in Ireland last weekend was a popular referendum. In all the other countries, and there are more than 20 now, and a large number of U.S. states have approved same-sex marriage, but they have done so either through the courts or through the legislatures. I'm thrilled to death. I'm still in sort of a state of disbelief, but I couldn't be happier and more proud of the Irish people and what the statement that they have chosen to make. So that's how the two paths are different.
Stephen Johnson, a freelance journalist, writes for publications in Ireland and America. We reached him in Ireland. Thanks, Stephen, for your perspective on this.
Thanks, Ben, and come see us on the Emerald Isle.
Okay, we'll make it a date. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And now to what has unfortunately become a regular part of News Buzz in recent weeks, an update on the spread of avian flu. Since last week, the highly pathogenic avian influenza has spread to more counties here in Iowa, now affecting more than a million additional birds. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden joins me now with an update. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
You've been following the story. What's the latest in the avian flu headline category?
Well, I guess the latest is that we've had another case in Wright County, so that makes four, and roughly a quarter of Iowa's layer hens before avian flu were located in Wright County, so that's upsetting, of course. And then we have our second southern Iowa case of avian flu in Adair County. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the latest.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about how the biosecurity measures have been helping? Have they?
Well, what we know is that they haven't been working very well because we still have outbreaks. That's not to say that they're completely useless. People should keep practicing safe biosecurity, but somehow the flu keeps infecting new flocks, and we still don't know how.
Let's talk about the impact that, well, now over 40 million birds having been euthanized has on the price of our eggs, for instance. What can you tell us about that?
Well, for processing eggs, so eggs used by food manufacturers, bakers, restaurants, those prices have definitely gone up. In fact, they've more than tripled since mid-April. And as Dave Swenson tweeted a couple days ago,
ISU economist
Dave Swenson, since roughly 20% perhaps of the nation's poultry have been affected by avian flu, but because prices have more than tripled, somebody's making a really big profit.
Did Dave Swenson or your other sources give you an indication if the egg prices are likely to continue to rise?
Well, they have started to taper, so they're still rising, but not at this kind of incredible clip. Partly that's because we've been now seeing fewer and fewer outbreaks. Instead of like four or five a day, it's maybe one or two a day or every other day. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say how high these prices will climb and when they'll start to normalize. And a lot of that depends on when we'll finally stop having outbreaks and when we can repopulate these facilities And that's really hard to say because disposal of the chicken carcasses has been taking a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Why has it been taking a long time? Tens of millions of birds?
Well, that number says it right there. There's a lot of birds. These facilities can have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million hens, and most of them are in small cages, and so you have to get them out of the cage, and then you have to euthanize the bird. A lot of times that's done with CO2, and then you have to compost the bird. And think about it, 5 million birds, you have to compost that. That's very difficult. With turkeys, a lot of times that's done on site. With chickens, you have to take that off site a lot of the times. So producers are trying to find landfills that will take the carcasses. And then you have to clean the facility, and it has to be vacant and clear of avian flu for like 6 weeks. So this all takes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. So what's the outlook as we get into the warmer summer months?
Hopefully outbreaks will stop. The USDA believes that warm weather and direct sunlight will kill the virus. But because it's thought that the virus is carried by migratory waterfowl, it's thought that more birds, when they fly south, will be carriers of the virus, and we could see a whole new rash of outbreaks.
Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Ben.
Finishing up the hour on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, here's one question, a one-question quiz to test your knowledge of Iowa in popular culture. What film from the late 1980s made these lines famous?
Hey, is this heaven?
No. It's Iowa.
Kevin Costner there delivering that line from the movie Field of Dreams. Now, this popular Hollywood film gave birth to Iowa's most iconic movie site in the city of Dyersville. It also ushered in a long, bitter legal battle that reached a milestone last week. Joining me to talk about that, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, with us again. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Ben. How you doing?
Very well. Before you get to the ruling, tell us, what was the dispute?
Well, that, you know, that magical little ball diamond in the middle of rural Iowa near Dyersville has, you know, kind of been dogged with disputes from the start amongst neighbors and townsfolk. You know, how do we manage this thing that has become such a tourist draw? This specifically centered on a group of neighbors, about 20 neighbors, the Residential and Agricultural Advisory Committee, they called themselves. And they had disputes with the new owners of the ballpark from Chicago, who planned to turn the land surrounding the Field of Dreams into a touring sports complex for, you know, youth baseball and softball teams. But the way the dispute ended up coming to court was the coalition of neighbors suing the city for improperly annexing and then rezoning the Field of Dreams and the surrounding farm from agricultural to commercial. So that's what has played out in court.
Mm-hmm. And so the coalition of neighbors, to put it simply, wanted it to stay more or less as it is and not be commercially developed.
Yeah, I mean, one simple explanation would be that they saw a Disneyland being built in their backyard when they didn't sign up for that, living where they do, you know, in rural Iowa and, you know, being farmers and you know, other or just people on an acreage in rural Iowa. They thought that was, even though there was this existing tourist draw, in their view, part of the whole reason for it was the fact that it's just a simple ball diamond in the middle of a cornfield on a farmstead with nothing else around it. Mm-hmm. So you build up all this infrastructure, they say, and that's not fair to the neighborhood. Now, specifically, they see what the city has done, and what they alleged was that there was crony capitalism going on. The city didn't follow its comprehensive plan. This was not foreseeable based on all the city plans and documents in the years leading up to it. And so that's really how they attacked it in court.
Mm-hmm. So what did the district court judge rule in this case?
Well, he ruled with the city. So basically, the city was fully sustained in everything it had done with its planning and zoning board, with the city council vote. You know, there was nothing improper. Nobody was coerced to vote one way or another. It was just, so the city fully won the Judge Bittner's ruling in district court in Dubuque. So, you know, everything that the neighbors alleged, they were going to have to appeal if they want to take this any further.
You expect there will be an appeal?
Yeah, officially the neighbors hadn't, you know, this just the news of this was just breaking, you know, this week, and the neighbors hadn't really had a chance to fully meet. But, you know, in talking to Matt Mesher, whose backyard, you know, overlooks the Field of Dreams, and he's been a lead spokesman for them, and also their attorney, it sounds pretty likely that they're going to try to appeal this.
I wanted to play a little clip from the film featuring James Earl Jones in a fabulous soliloquy here, very stirring here, and then sort of get your reaction, your reflections on, well, the irony of what he's saying, but also the way this film touched Americans and I guess the world. Let's hear this. This is the scene where the character played by Kevin Costner is facing foreclosure. He's being pressured perhaps to sell off the property, and James Earl Jones is telling him, don't do it.
Ray, when the bank opens in the morning, they'll foreclose.
People will come, Ray.
You're broke, Ray. You sell now or you lose everything.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good and it could be again.
What a scene, James Earl Jones. Powerful. Kyle Munson, I'll give you a moment to shake off those goose pimples and and also the tear from your eye. What has made this film touch so many people, become what it has become? What did you say a quarter century later?
Yeah, no, that is a beautiful moment in the film, and James Earl Jones still loves that as well. Well, I mean, obviously, Field of Dreams, or, you know, W.P. Kinsella, you know, who wrote the original story that's based on, they didn't invent this whole notion of baseball as a metaphor for life, but it kind of does crystallize that nicely in such a very personal, simple, touching, you know, kind of rural fable. Somebody like Kevin Costner, when, you know, we connected with him last year during the 25th anniversary celebration, and, you know, he said it's, you know, film, this is a film that makes men weep. You know, you have that father-son connection or sense of loss, or that wistful longing to have a reconnection with your, you know, your parents. That's central to it. This is what Hollywood does so well over and over, or tries to, right? You know, this whole notion of chase your dreams, follow your dreams, and this film definitely has a heavy strain of that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in Iowa, we also relate to this whole connection with the land. This here is a specific spot, a peaceful, you know, rural shrine to your dreams, to that notion of family, what's important. I mean, all that has just sustained what was kind of a simple film that was not a blockbuster initially, but and, you know, we're not sitting here talking about the movie Twister, which made millions more dollars, and it also was filmed in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about this because it's really kind of continued to echo and build through the years. So, you know, anytime as a journalist I've been at the field in recent years, you run into somebody from Chicago, from Hawaii, from wherever, and it's still, and they still come to kind of echo what, you know, what that monologue was saying, what James Earl Jones was saying there. They come for whatever that sense of peace or stillness is that they're looking for, you know.
Right. Your words, ironic at this point, a film that makes men weep. Perhaps we should change that, a film that makes lawyers weep.
Well, and, you know, and that was kind of baked into the script from the start, too. Obviously, you know, with, you know, the Costner, the character's brother-in-law there telling him to just sign the damn papers and sell the thing.
Right.
So then shortly after the, you know, once the film was kind of starting to kind of create its legend and the field was saved. Initially, it was partially plowed up, but then saved. There were disputes, you know, there was split ownership of the field amongst neighbors. And then finally, one, you know, just the Lansings owned the field themselves for a long time. But it is churned with that sort of dispute as well. So it's had the magic and it's had the mess from the beginning.
Kyle Munson, we'll check in with you on the next update that we need from the Field of Dreams. Thanks so much, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist.
Thanks.
For the Des Moines Register. Thanks, Kyle.
You bet. Take care.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.